Go. This is 1866 Sport. Go. This is 1866 Sport.
Well, welcome to Weekend Warm-Up with me, Phil Tooley.
Me, Ellie Yates.
We've got a great show for you today. All of our time is going to be devoted to chatting to one of the Spartak's backroom staff. We've all got to know and love Danny Webb. Gary Roberts had a stellar playing spell here on Whittington Moor before returning as coach under manager Paul Cook, here, of course, for his second spell. Dave O'Hare, better known as Bookie, is one of our own. He comes from town, he's a supporter. But there's another vital cog in that wheel that we all know, from being a player that won 33 England caps, was voted into the PFA's Premier League Team of the Year, from being a young kid that was frequently on the front pages of the tabloids for a myriad of different reasons. Killing a Ferrari is the one that stands out to me. He played for his hometown club, Ipswich Town, before reaping the rewards of the Premier League with Newcastle United and then West Ham United. Never far away from a major injury, never far away from controversy. We all know who he is, but there are very few people who really know who he is. So we're having him here for an in-depth chat, and it'll help us to all get to know and understand Kieran Dyer. Well, welcome to 1866 Sport, Kieran, and thanks for coming on.
Cheers for having me.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. First of all, how are you physically after the major scare regarding your liver disease and subsequent transplant?
Yeah, it was well documented that basically I was on my deathbed. It was 6 months on the 19th of this month. It was 6 months after my operation, and I'm doing really, really well. I came back to work for the Watford game, and I've been back ever since. Bloods are fine, doing really, really well. And my aim now is I'm back in the gym, and before the end of the season, I want to get on the training pitch and actually join in the five-a-sides, because I still think I'm better than some of our players. That's a joke.
But, you know, up until the point of the transplant, and in your excellent book, which we'll probably talk about at some stage, All Too Soon, Smart Too Late, you talk about the wait for a transplant, knowing that when a transplant comes up, it means somebody's died, sadly. Yeah. How was that period of time? Because you've got to find a match. Yeah. Somebody who has got that compatibility, but you know that somebody's paid the ultimate sacrifice for it. How was that wait?
Yeah, so I think the fans kind of noticed that I was there for the majority pre-season. We played the two Sheffield clubs. And I can remember waking up I was staying in the Ringwood, and I woke up about 1 o'clock in the morning, and by this time I'd started to get really yellow, so I knew my symptoms were getting worse, but I started swelling up everywhere, and I had this excruciating pain in my chest area, and I could have gone to the Chesterfield A&E, but I knew it was time for me that I needed my transplant. So I got a taxi straight from Chesterfield all the way down to Cambridge, Adam Brooks. I left a message for the gaffer. I will not be returning into training. They see me at the hospital in Cambridge, and I didn't leave the hospital. So this is probably June, end of June time, and I was in hospital from that period of time all the way until October. So I was in hospital for over 3 months, and it was, like I said, I was at the lowest of lows. I was dying. It got to the stage where my family were worried that I wouldn't get a donor in time. I did get a donor. Again, unfortunately, that meant someone had to die. Since I've come out of hospital, the family have wrote to me. They've got in touch with me. Uh-huh. I know all about my donor. Obviously, that would be private between me and the family. The family know who I am now. So I'm not just living life for myself now. I'm living life for my donor as well. So everything I do in life now, it's not just for me, it's for him. So, yeah.
And the disease, primarily sclerosing cholangitis. When were you first diagnosed with it? How long had you been living with it?
So basically, which is remarkable, because I always used to beat myself up about my career that I didn't live life right with my diet and going out too much. But I got diagnosed with an autoimmune condition of my liver in 2002,
which was
just before the World Cup. But the PSC disease that you were talking about got diagnosed in 2016. So I've had liver disease, like I said, from early 2000. So to have even any kind of career dealing with that is quite remarkable and shows you what the human body can do. But in 2016 was the news that I was going to need a liver transplant eventually. Yeah, and it just happened that it happened in 2023.
And not long before that, we'll talk about the reality shows a little bit later on. You had a collapsed lung as well.
Yeah, that was that was doing Ant Middleton and the SAS. There's, again, that's that competitive nature that footballers and competitors have. And I always thought I'd complete that show. And, yeah, I fractured my rib and had a punctured lung. And, yeah, it was the toughest show I've ever done.
I mean, throughout your playing career, treatment rooms, hospitals have sadly been no strangers to you. And having read the book in the last 24 hours, I just listed some of the ailments because people will sort of think, oh, yeah, he was always out injured. Mm. Well, it's not like one thing. Broken leg, and the first time you carried on and scored with a broken leg, didn't you, in that game?
Yeah.
Compartment syndrome, calf operation, shin operation, stress fracture of your foot, medial ligaments, broken leg just before the 2002 World Cup, autoimmune hepatitis, a serious hamstring which had a poor diagnosis, became a major problem, peritonitis, you might talk about this one, training pole in the eye.
Yeah.
Broken leg, a double fracture which required four operations, came back straight away, a broken nose, and a foot injury. You know, so it wasn't one thing, was it?
Yeah, again, so again, as players, and rightly so, when you look at all my injuries I had there, I was labelled as a sick note. And one of the things that I've since realised that because of my liver problems, it slows down your healing. You're more susceptible to getting injuries. So when you overview it all, I think I've had, not including the liver operation, before then I'd had 15 operations.
Sure.
I dislocated my shoulder, which is not in there as well.
Yeah,
so I've had a lot of injuries. And it's all footballers do is want to play football. Mm. And I think I talked about, especially the time at West Ham, it got to the stage where you're embarrassed, and I used to have a ripped hamstring and refused to come off the pitch. So I'd rip my hamstring after 10 minutes and I would play for half an hour just to get to half time so I didn't have to do the dreaded walk when the substitute board came up. So it does affect you mentally. So when I see players here who've got injuries like Coco, he had a really long injury. I speak to him a lot and try and keep his spirits up because you kind of get forgotten when... especially when the team are doing well as well. So I think when Coco came off against Gateshead and then we won the next seven games on the trot, and everyone thinks this club can do without a Ryan Colclough, and then obviously when we've had our bad spell of late, you realise how important them kind of players are, and it's just keeping their spirits up and stuff like that.
And when you're playing, what is the frustration like when you just come back and then something different comes on, or it's the same thing that... You know, particularly like the hamstring in that real 18 months or so before that was properly diagnosed and worked on.
Yeah, the missed diagnosis is the horrible one. Like with my hamstring, I was out for I missed a whole season. Graham Souness lost his job that summer. He was building the whole team around me. They kept telling me it was a hamstring strain. Then it was something to do with my back. Then my hamstrings were too weak. Then my glute wasn't firing. And all it was in the end, after a year, we found out that I had a thing called peritendinitis, and all I needed was a steroid injection and I would have been back within 2 weeks. So I get classed as injury prone when I could have probably have helped Graham Souness keep his job. So that's how important having a good medical team is. That's one thing, like what shocked me when I came to Chesterfield, more importantly, was we're a National League team. And I look at the staff, I look at Jack, who does the analyst, and I've been fortunate that I've been in England camps, I've been in top Premier League clubs, and our staff are not National League level. From Jack, the analyst, from the manager, who's easily a Championship manager,
yeah.
Gary Roberts, the staff, Danny Webb, you got Ben, the physio. Everyone talks about this massive squad we've apparently got. We've done the research. We've used 23 players this season. We've got no more players to use. We've got young Connor Cook, young Archie, young Xander, and young George. They're the only four players that haven't played for us this season. We've used 23 players. The gaffer said to Ash and Phil, if we get the training pitches right, with our coaches, with our medical team, with Jordan, we will get it right, and it's been proven. The gaffer always wanted quality over quantity. So that's another thing that really riles me up is, we've got the biggest budget. No, we haven't got the biggest budget. We're probably third or fourth.
Yeah.
We've got the biggest squad. Well, we've just proven we've got the smaller squad. It's just everything to put our players down. Our players deserve all the love and credit in the world. They've been an absolute credit to this, to the fans, to us as staff. We can only pat them on the back. We must be the luckiest team in the league as well, because every time we win a game, I read the reports after the game, we deserved at least a draw. This is nearly every manager in the league.
Everyone.
We must be a very lucky team because we should be on. We should have probably drawn about 25 games this season and not won. And then I could go on. There was one manager who came out and said, Gates said we're the best team in the league. And I'm thinking, when he said that, he said this in December and we were 20 points clear of Gates. And that's no disrespect to Gates because I love Rob. When Rob came in, we played Gateshead when they're at their lowest. They'd lost.
Oh, he'll have probably been at Newcastle the same time as you then. Yeah,
I know him through Newcastle. He'd lost five of their best players. They got a good hiding here, but I felt sorry for him because we played at the lowest. But he'll be the first to say. I think he came out after the press and said, "We are a juggernaut." It's just like everyone wants to knock our players. Before I came here, all I ever heard about was that the National League is the hardest league to get out of. Mm. But all of a sudden this season, just because Wrexham have gone, what Chesterfield doing should be expected. It's like, give our players the credit that they deserve. They are unbelievable. It pains me as well because the last few weeks where we haven't been getting the results, you'd think that we'd bottom of the league.
Yes.
We beat Oxford at home. And I was like, just because we didn't play spectacular, we won. We went 24 points clear and we're having to G up our lads. Like, I feel like it's such a tricky position for them where they are because they're so far ahead. At least where Notts County and Wrexham, they had each other to go off.
Yes.
We tried to get into them, but I've been a player. Trust me, complacency sets in. It's just natural. Some days you just think you're going to turn up and it's just going to happen. It doesn't. Every team we play, it's their cup final.
Yeah.
We go through every clips. Gary Roberts loves watching clips, by the way. I've got to
say. Right, okay.
Gary Roberts will be at York on a Tuesday. It will be down at the following week. He'll be down Borehamwood on a Tuesday. He studies football. We watch all the clips. We see all the players who cheat, who don't work hard. And we play against us, and they're like marathon runners.
Yeah.
It's just like, I've never seen a team work so hard. And this is what our players have to deal with every week. And to break every record, we're going to win the league. I know Danny Webb and the gaffer, they say, we've won the league and they deserve all the credit in the world because they are fantastic players.
It's great to hear you talking so passionately about the club. But what was it that drew you to Chesterfield?
I must confess, so it's quite funny. So I formed a great relationship with Paul Cook at Ipswich and Gary Roberts. I was doing the under-21s. Paul Cook, on his first day, was coming in to sack me. So Lee O'Neill was head of football at Ipswich at the time, and the gaffer spoke to him and he got the job. And I was very unhappy at Ipswich because I'm too emotionally invested into that club. It is my club, and I see how bad the club was with personnel, how it was run, and I was unhappy. So one thing that Paul Cook the gaffer models himself on is that he loves happiness in a football club. So I got a phone call from Lee O'Neill just saying the manager wants to see you. Little did I know he was coming in to sack me. So he came down and we had a chat and he could see my passion and hurt for the club and we just hit it off instantly. I think he was on a few weeks ago and obviously he's not going to go into slagging people off or why it went wrong at Ipswich. I honestly believe he wasn't given enough time. He deserves a lot of credit for the main core of their players, their most important players, were Paul Cook signings. And when he told me that he was taking the Chesterfield job, it shocked me because, like I said, I regard him as a top Championship manager. I think with all the promotions, obviously he loved the club and he came to sign for the club. And I'd watched the odd game when TNT actually put us on TV, which is not very often, but we won't go into that. And
too busy with Wrexham.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So I watched a few games, and obviously we lost in the playoffs that year. I was instrumental in helping him sign the Mondo Dobra in the summer. Obviously, Dobbs is a kid that I'd had at Ipswich since I was 15. The gaffer and Robbo were onto him. They knew how close I was with the Dobbs. I said, listen, Dobbs, you know I wouldn't give you wrong advice. You know what Paul Cook is as a man, as a manager. So obviously when Dobbs signed, I was definitely extra invested with the manager and Dobbs and Gary Roberts. And it was just, what was it? The first game I came was Bradford in pre-season, last season. The stadium blew me away straight away. I was like, wow, this is actually a big club. And then that game against Bradford, we absolutely pummeled them on the day. I think Mark Hughes came in. I wasn't part of the staff, but I was down in the with the gaffer after the game. Mark Hughes couldn't speak highly enough about Chesterfield, and I thought, wow, they're really on to something. And it was, I think, midway through that tricky run, about 7 or 8 games, I was just speaking to the gaffer, and I could tell he was kind of, I don't think there was the budget for me to come in, but you could tell he was just a different eyes, a different voice for the players. And I just said, look, I don't want to get paid. I'll just come volunteer to help out. Obviously, the club would provide accommodation for me. And I think my first game was, I didn't actually take any training. I think I was on the bench for Wrexham. And I think a few days later, we got that last-minute goal against Gateson. And then it's just been, for me, it was just upwards every time. He lets me coach. He lets me and Gary Roberts get some of the coaching. Webby's more the set-piece kind of set pieces and the organisation. And we just hit it off really well. And obviously, we fell a little bit short. And that gave me extra motivation that if the club wanted me, I would be here next season. And thankfully, the club and the gaffer wanted me here, and I'm here and really enjoying life.
Yeah, so you touched a bit there on coaching. Could you tell us a bit more about what that entails and sort of your day-to-day role with the club?
So obviously because of my illness, we brought Paddy in as well, and Paddy's terrific, enthusiastic young coach. He's obviously at a Premier League club. He's a proper modern-day coach. So like I said, Webby likes to do the set pieces and organising the lads with times and sorting out all that kind of stuff. The gaffer does his shape work, and then the training is just left to us three. Because there's three of us and we're all ambitious and we all want our time on the grass. We can argue in the morning who's going to do what and that, but we've come with a great pattern. Some days I'll do the majority of the training while Gary assists me, and then Paddy will finish with the games. But we do the first team training. I think I'm brought in to be, I'm like the argumentative one with the gaffer. I think that I always want to know the why, the what and the how, but what if a team's do this and what if they do this? And I kind of, so everything he comes out with, I want to be the master technician who can thwart him. So I'm like, and it's like we're back and forth. It's great. It's nothing personal. It's just great opinions of football. Yeah. And I really enjoy that. And one of the great things about the gaffer is he empowers us as coaches. Like you see Danny Webb doing the press. I can do the press sometimes if I want. Robbo can do the press, just to give us that kind of experience of what it is like to be in the manager's thing, in the manager's position. We can also, every time he has a meeting with Phil and Ash, like Boardman, and about budgets or about recruitment, we will come into that to kind of learn the football club. And you don't get that access at every football club, and that's one compliment I can't say enough good things about the manager with regards to that. He shocked me when he came to Ipswich how good he was tactically, but I think the biggest compliment I can give him as a man manager is that I put him up there with Bobby Robson. The players absolutely love him. Another thing like fans don't really get to see is that I'm telling you now, if I was a player and I played well at the weekend and scored 2 goals, if the manager was telling me he's given me a rest on Tuesday, I am losing it. I am totally losing it. Our players, with this rotation, they could play so well and they know they're not playing on Tuesday, and there's not one bit of disappointment. And another, and what is so hard as well, like you just look at DJ when he had that run of like 10 games when he was absolutely on it. It's because he's playing regular. For players to come out come back in, come out, come back in, and to still try to keep up their standards is very, very hard. Mm. And our players, again, need so much credit for that, how they can just come in, come out. Like Mike, I was looking at Mike Jones's record the other day. Mike Jones's record is like, I think he's lost one in about 30 games or something. It's just incredible. So it is one of the hardest things for players, trust me, is to consistently play well when you haven't got the rhythm of the game. There's like, there's so much talk. Like, for an example, I can give a Jeff King. So everyone's saying, oh, Jeff King's not on it. One, Jeff King hasn't played regularly for a start. And the season Jeff King had last season was like a freak in nature. I think he had about 15, 20 assists and like 8 goals from right back. Some right backs in their whole career, like a 15 season career, aren't going to get them numbers. He got that in one season. So when people say Jeff King is off it, no, he's just having a normal season. Yeah. He's probably played the less games out of all our fullbacks, and he's probably got more assists than them all. That's what Jeff King does. He's an assister, and he hasn't played regularly. It's like we read so much into everything. Again, our defence, like everyone talks about our defence, and we've sacrificed the defence this season. We have sacrificed the defence this season because, do you know why we've sacrificed the defence this season? Because we scored 97 goals. So in the summer, when the gaffer's planning and he goes, you look at our firepowers, Grigg, Jacobs, Dobra, Banks, Mandeville, Coco, Berry, Quigley, Curtis, these are all match winners. So if you, I'm telling you, everyone goes and watch England tomorrow against Brazil after our game, if you're not in the pub celebrating, and you watch every top team, Man City, whether it be Man City, Liverpool, they defend with five and they attack with five. So you've got like two units. So they always have 4-5 behind the ball. This season, for a lot of majority of the games, we have three defending and we have seven attacking. The gaffer's always used to have his centre midfielders really low to back up the thing. Tom Naylor scored 14 goals. He's now attacking. So when we go into next season, the gaffer, I think one of the reporters asked, and he said he's not going into next season, but the manager and the coaches know next season, we probably won't be able to go as gung-ho. So obviously the defence are getting a lot of stick, but trust me when I say we're already ahead of that and we will fix that problem. Just everyone stay positive, give everyone their flowers with the players because they deserve it all.
I think that's one of the things as well, like with you saying about the players and how they are with Cook. It's just that trust as well. Yeah. That, you know, he knows what he's doing. Players know what they're supposed to be doing.
No disrespect to any manager in the National League, or no disrespect to most of the managers in the League 2. They don't sign Will Grigg and Tom Naylor and Michael Jacobs and Armando Dobra. It's like at Ipswich. Morsey doesn't come back to Ipswich if it wasn't for Paul Cook. Connor Chaplin doesn't come. That's the way it is. He's just, like I said, the biggest compliment I can pay that man is we're talking about a national treasure in Bobby Robson, and he has that same lovable effect in players, and you're seeing it on the football pitch.
Anyway, in the book, Kieran, you spoke about many managers that you've worked with. There's precious little, really, that indicates that they devoted a lot of time trying to develop players, whether they're young, more experienced. Is that because the level you played at was so demanding that managers wanted ready-made players? And do you think your career or the careers of other players you played with would have benefited with more one-to-one, small group development work like you've talked about?
I think if you look at when I first broke into first teams and even towards up to the middle of my career, you'd have a first team manager and his assistant manager, and that were the only coaches in the thing, and it was all geared to the team on a Saturday. So I always said in my book, and we'll touch on Brian Kluger, who was a Chesterfield player, he was the most influential coach I had because I had him through my Ipswich Academy. I stopped being coached when I got into the first team, because when I went into the first team, it's not about developing Kieran Dyer now, it's about getting the result and getting the 3 points. I think in today's football now, especially hopefully when we're in when we're in League Two and we get our academy, because we've got four. I mentioned Archie and the lads. They come and train with us every day to make up numbers, and they're doing really well. But like I said, because we've got me, Paddy, Robbo, the gaffer, we can now give time for extras. It's been very hard in the second part of the season because the games are coming thick and fast with the rearranged games, but in the early part of next season and in pre-season we'll be going out in the afternoons and we'll be developing these players, because for me that's my passion. You can talk about all the accolades I've had as a professional footballer. The biggest high I've ever had in football was when Dobbs scored that goal at Wembley, because I'd worked with him about 15. He'd gone from a boy who couldn't reach the goal from that far out to doing countless finishing with Gary Roberts and the staff at Chesterfield. And I've, like I said, I've seen him develop from 15, and I've been a part of his like journey so far. So when he cuts in on his right foot at Wembley on the biggest stage of all and bends that in the top corner, that was the most proudest I felt as a like as a player or coach. Because when you're a player, you're so self-driven. You're in a team, but it is all about you and you, and you're self-driven for you. When you're a coach or a manager, you've got all these players that you have to, like, you have a relationship with. Like, I get more upset about losing a game now as a coach than I do when I was a player. It's a crazy how the kind of, it just flips, and it's that's one of the, like I said, the biggest joys for me is, like, if we get the result tomorrow and we're on that pitch celebrating, that'll probably, I'll probably cry. I'll be so overwhelmed.
Same.
Yeah, you're on your own. You mentioned about Brian Clough.
Yeah.
Was here as a player, came from, I think it was Derby County, John Duncan, who played at Derby in the latter stages of his playing career, brought him here 83, 84, and he followed Dunks down to Ipswich when he moved there in 87. Why was he so special? Why does he stand out in your early career more than anybody else?
He made every good part of, yes, I had natural ability, but through his dedication and him crafting my skills, he made the player that I am today. And it's not just with me. If you look, I think he went through all the players he's developed through Ipswich in his time, and he's probably, for Ipswich Town, he's probably made them over 100 million. There's like Darren Bent, who's gone on to play for England, myself, there's Titus Bramble, there's Connor Wickham, there's Darren Ambrose, there's Richard Wright, there's James Scott. These are all gone on to Premier League players who have been millions and millions of pounds with the clubs. And like I said, that's why I want to be a developer. If you look at football today, because managers don't get time, it's all about the results. And players become robots nowadays because they have to do exactly what managers do. So the decision making go out of the game. So it's basically, I'm manager, you have to run here when I tell you, you have to cross it when I tell you, you have to do it here. And I think that kind of hinders player development. Sometimes you have to trust the players to make the decisions. When they make the wrong decisions, you can give them your reason why for making the decisions. And again, that's why I love this setup. And
yeah, well, Cookie's very much that. You're a good player. You wouldn't be here if you had a good player. Go out and play.
That's Paul Cook to a T. He gave, like I said, he gave a lot of kids chances at Ipswich, even in his short time there. And I'm, like I said, hopefully in the next few years when we get our academy up and building, who knows if we win the league early. And like I said, there's been some young lads who are playing. They'll be on the bench and they'll get to experience it as well.
Brilliant. So apart from Brian, you mentioned several other players and people that have had connections with the Spirites in your book.
Yeah.
None other than Gus Ulenbeek.
Yeah.
Tell us more about him and what your role was.
Probably Gus was probably the only player who was quicker than me in my career. He was that quick. And I love Gus because I was his boot boy and he gave me the biggest tip ever. I can remember being on a youth contract. It was a YTS then. I was on like £47.50 a week in them days, and Gus used to give me like £100 at Christmas, and I was like, that was like I'd won the lottery. I just absolutely always looked after me. He wore Asics and went to Nike, and he'd always give me his hands, he'd give me his boots and stuff like that, and I just absolutely loved him. But what was quite funny was that so I was his boot boy, and he'd always pass me down for boots. And then when I was 17, I signed my first Adidas contract because I was playing for England under 18s and 19s, and I was well sought after. So they used to send me loads of Predators, and I'd have my names on them, and then I was handing him boots down, going, there you go. So he kind of liked the banter of it. But yeah, he was a terrific servant for Ipswich. Yeah,
yeah. The £47.50 is not quite true, because didn't your mum give you 50 of the 60 quid for board as well? So you're rolling in it.
We used to get 60 quid digs money. My mum wouldn't take all, she gave it to me, so I was the richest youth team player.
Well, and then there was Dean Saunders, who was Graham Souness' assistant at Newcastle United. He's not the most popular man in these parts, Dean Saunders, but I believe he was good for you.
Yeah, Dean Saunders' role at Newcastle was completely different to Chesterfield. So when he was at Newcastle, Graham Souness was the bad cop. You always have a bad cop and good cop. And Dean Saunders was quite a witty guy, so he was the good cop. So as soon as we'd come down and he's going to beat us up and da-da-da-da, and then Dean Saunders behind the scenes would be picking us back up. So he would be a good number two, but I could see why he would find it hard to be a number one. But again, I've only got great things to say about him. Like I said, he was the good cop. With Graham Soonish, you definitely need a good cop from time
to
time.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds as though he was quite a bad cop. Yeah, absolutely. And when you moved on to West Ham, Louis Boamorte, who came here because he was a pal of Mark Crossley's, who was a coach at the time, and young Zavon Hines, who scored Chesterfield's first goal in the National League down at Ebbsfleet in 2018. Martin Allen signed Hines up here, who of course is well known down in those parts. What are your thoughts of what do you remember about those two guys?
Louis Boamorte, he was getting a tough time at West Ham with the fans, but he was like, when I was talking about our players and when they're not playing and how there's no disappointment and they're rooting for each other and the rotation, Louis Boamorte was like going through a hard time at West Ham. But he was the life and soul of the change room. He was the character that the change room needed. He was like, he didn't have to have the captain's armband. He didn't have to be in the players' committee, but he was there for all with his teammates. And it's no surprise that he's gone on and he's coaching at Fulham. And I think he's just took a national job.
Yeah.
So, and Savon Hines was a young kid coming through at West Ham. He had some ability. I'm surprised he didn't kick on the way I thought he was going to. He's now a West Ham. I think he does West Ham under-16s.
Because he was doing some bits and bobs at Bromley, wasn't he?
Yeah, West Ham under-16. I think he's in the West Ham Academy now. So he's got his coaching badges and he's going to hopefully be a coach one day as well. So that's good.
And another connection. Neil Warnock started his playing career at Chesterfield and managed you at QPR. Is he really like what we all think he's like?
Yep, he is. I remember... I was towards the end of my career and I met him and he signed me in a car park. He said, well, you're not doing a medical, just sign this form. I was thinking, lucky me, I don't have to try and pass the medicals because I'd have probably failed. But yeah, he's not a great coach or anything like that, but as a man manager, proper old school, players used to love him. You'd used to win on a Saturday and he'd say, I'll see you on a Thursday. So you can imagine, okay, cheers, got 5 days off, people would be booking little trips to Dubai and Marbella and off they were going. But again, I got on really well with him. So when I made my debut, this shows his character. And I remember I made my debut and I broke my foot in the first game of the season. And I remember going to see the surgeon and he said, we could operate now or you could do 6 months. So if I had the operation, I'd be out for the season. He said, you could rehab it for 6 months and then hopefully that works, so you come back. I was adamant I wanted the operation because I know how cursed I am. They said, no, do the 6 months rehab. So I did the 6 months rehab. My first game back in a behind closed door game, I redone my foot again. So I'd wasted 6 months again on my career. And I can remember going into the physio room and I was crying because that was it. I was saying that was me done now. So I was basically crying. There was a physio in and then all of a sudden the door opened. It's Neil Warnock and he kicks the physio out and it's just me and him. And he breaks down crying and gives me a big hug. And they're both two grown men crying in the change room. And I thought that was really endearing and it kind of summed him up that he really cared for you. And I like that about him.
Yeah, and well, he's had a lot of success at a lot of different levels, hasn't he? You've expressed a desire to manage at some stage in the future. And every manager takes something good or bad from managers they've worked for. Just so people are aware, your list of gaffers includes, it's not exclusively the full list, but Craig Burley at Ipswich, Rude Hullett, who signed you at Newcastle, Bobby Robson, who you've mentioned, Glenn Roeder, Graeme Souness, Alan Kirbishley, Gianfranco Zola, and Harry Redknapp. What are the main tips of the trade that you'll take from any of those guys, and are there many of the tips of the trade that you'll steer well clear of?
I think the biggest thing for me is man management. I think that if you can get players on the pitch 100% confident and 100% will love you and they were run through brick walls for you. I think that's half the battle. If you look at my Newcastle team, we didn't have a world-class player. Shearer was world-class, but at the time we were getting in the Champions League, he was past his prime, so I wouldn't say he was world-class. We had a very good team, don't get me wrong, but we had no world-class players. And we were competing with Arsenal, the invincible teams, and we were competing with the United treble-winning teams. Year in, year out, we were coming third and fourth. And like I said, we didn't have the players, but every time I went on that pitch with Bobby Robson, I thought I was the best player in the world. And if you can make a player feel they're the best player in the world, you've done your job well, because that player will be on that pitch playing with so much confidence, and playing with confidence can give you an extra 5-10%. So that's the biggest thing I would take. And obviously, if you've seen with the gaffer, and I think he's mentioned it to me, and you've got to get your recruitment right. You look at, not many people will know this, and I put my job on the line. So we're in Portugal, and we had the disappointment at Wembley, and I'm a reflector. So on the day, we probably deserved to beat Notts County when you think of overall chances, and they had a couple of goalkeeper errors. But if you think about it, Notts County, our four substitutes on the day, we had to take Mandeville off, who was our player of the year. We had to take Dallas off, who was our main scorer at that time. We had to take Coco off, who was our most destructive player. And we had to take our little wizard off, Dobbs. So we had to take, that's nearly 50 goals. So fair play to Notts County, because the way they kept the ball and tired them out, and we had to substitute them off, we might have had to win the game, but give them credit, because our four best attacking players probably last season were on the bench. So they did something well. So obviously we had the disappointment of that. We went to Portugal, and it was 2 days into Portugal. So we had Griggy with us, we had Tom Naylor with us, and we had Harry. And they were training so well, and their mentality was right. And I knew that we were after Michael Jacobs, and I knew we were after Freckleton, and they were getting close. And we finished training one day, and training was brilliant. It was just me and Robbo and the gaffer. And my exact words to the gaffer is, if we don't get this team up promoted this season, I haven't done my job, and I deserve to be sacked. I would leave, because I don't think I've done my job. That's how confident I was with that group of players, and it was all from the recruitment and the mindset of the players. So when he was able to get them senior players in, Frex, who's an absolute beast, it's a shame we haven't got him towards the end of the season, but recruitment is massive in football, and
And you want to get that recruitment in early. And I was chatting with Paul Cook off air before the Halifax match on Wednesday night, and he said, do you know how long it was, Phil? How long it is since we signed a player? And Ash Kirk had told me 2 days before it was 198 days.
Yeah.
So I said 201 days. So he wasn't very pleased that I knew the answer to that. But that shows the recruitment. 31st or 30th of August, Freckleton coming in on loan. That was the last one. Been nonsense.
Exactly. And like I said, it's a credit that the squad have stayed fit. You can't help impact injuries like we suffered with Coco and that, and obviously it's unfortunate with Griggy that's just happened, but that was more to do with the pitch at Halifax, I think, than training loads or game loads. And like I said, we backed our training pitches, we backed ourselves as coaches, we backed our physios and Jordan, and we're reaping the rewards of it. We got our business early, done early. They all got to see the gaffer's patterns, shape, and we've had the best season in Chesterfield history. So long may it continue.
Just how hard was Graeme Souness?
Well, he offered to beat, when me and Liam Bowyer had that fight, he offered to take both of us on, and I think he would have beaten both of us probably about 9.5 seconds. So, yeah, so that's how hard he is. I'm not saying that doesn't sound very hard, just me and Liam Bowyer, but to beat us both up in 9 seconds is pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah, with a man with a heart problem, it was a fair few years on the clock as well.
Exactly.
Brilliant, yeah.
So you touched on Wembley a little bit earlier with Chesterfield, but as an Ipswich lad, how disappointing was it to play, you know, three straight playoffs for Ipswich but not manage to make it to Wembley with them?
I know. It was, like I said, to lose three consecutive playoffs with Ipswich, and not even get to Wembley. Like, you'd think, oh, OK, you'd win the semi-final and get to Wembley and maybe lose at Wembley. I never got to. So when we beat Bromley, I said, just surely I'm going to win a playoffs. It's been four times. The averages are going to work out that we won. And like I said, when Dobbs scored that goal, I thought it was. But like I said, to sometimes to push forward, you have to have setbacks. I learned that with my life. I learned that with my career. I say in my book, I think the headline says it all. Like, if I'd have known now, then I could have had 100 caps for England. And obviously, if it wasn't for the liver problems and stuff like that, and obviously the disappointment. And like I said, when I reflected and watched it back, and it just wasn't meant to be. Fair play to Notts County and fair play to Wrexham. And look, we've now had the best season ever in our history, and we're going to be better prepared for when we're in League Two.
Yeah, when you broke it to the English, so I was still at a young age, you were still playing for the under-21s and everything along those lines. You cite your debut against Luxembourg, despite you only playing the first 45 minutes before a bit of cramp that turned into other things. Yeah. Just how did you feel on that day as an individual, as somebody, how do your parents feel? Just what was that like?
Yeah, it was great because I got told, it was Kevin Keegan who was manager, and he told me... He told me early in the week, he said, he used to come out with some balmy things, and so usually when I used to go with England later on, you basically knew what the team was before you got there. It didn't need to matter on form. It was basically Beckham, Gerrard, Lampard, Scholes playing, Rooney and Owen, the back four, Ferdinand, Terry, Ashley Cole and Gary Neville. You knew that was the team. It was just... nothing you could do to break into it. And fair enough, listen, we're talking about 11 of England's finest ever players. But with Kevin Keegan, he would just go on hunches and that. And I trained well that week. And I hadn't played right back for about 2 years. I played as a wing back from time to time. And he just said, you're playing right back. So all my family came, like coaches of family. I invited Brian Klug down for the day. So Brian came to watch. I had about 40 people there. And to have that debut where... I got brought down for a penalty early. I assisted Shearer's third goal. I think I had 3 assists. It was 4-0 at half time. And like you said, I thought I had cramp, but it was my ongoing calf problems, which I found out later in my career. So I went for some treatment off the pitch. And then when I was running back up the sideline to get the ref's attention, the whole of Wembley, this was old Wembley as well with all its history, there was over 80,000 people and they were all singing, "There's only one Kieran Dyer." And like I said, that was... the high of highs for me at that point in my life and career, like I said, and for the Dobbs goal to upstage it, it just goes to show you how proud I am as a coach. But yeah, it doesn't get any better, because that's what you dream of in the classrooms, of playing for your country and having the fans sing, you know.
Yeah, you've spoken about many England players playing with fear or even limited ambition compared to when they play for their clubs, and you make reference to that in your book, especially the match against Andorra. Why do you think that fear is there, and do you think that Gareth Southgate recognises that?
Yeah, of course. Well, Gareth Southgate was part of the squad, and there was such a massive disconnect between fans and players. There was such astronomical money in the game. Mm-hmm. We were all on ridiculous wages. And we were, the FA at the time, shied us away from interacting with fans. So they didn't get to really see us as people. So with all that talent, we were classed as the golden generation. And when you're not winning... it started to become really toxic. And then you see what happened to David Beckham in the World Cup. You see what happened to Phil Neville. Then there was Ashley Cole. There was a stage when we're talking about England's greatest left-back of all time. There was a stage where he was getting booze. So me, when my mindset was when I was playing at Newcastle, and I was free and I wanted to express myself. When you went for England, you were worried about that mistake. That mistake that could cost your team and get you knocked out of the World Cup, that you'll be hammered, your family will get hammered. So I just went onto the pitch and I just wanted to get the ball as quick as I could and pass it off and think, I haven't made a mistake. And I think that the fear, not just me, I think it got to all of our players in that generation, and I feel that's why we didn't go on to win. Gareth Southgate, straight away, when he came in to be England manager, he got the players, the fans, he gets the media can come into, have all access with the players. He does like the Super Bowl round table where every player has to go to every kind of section of the press, and it just brings everyone together and the fans feel more connected, and that's why England are doing so well and they're expressing themselves, and like I said, if he picks the right team, I think we've got a great chance in the
summer. So when you're working with players, Kieran, then, how do you try and take any of that fear of failure out of their minds? Because it's got to be there, hasn't it? It's got to be there at any level of football.
Yeah, I think there's a great saying. I think that sometimes people say the first step's the hardest. I think sometimes getting over the finish line is the hardest. And I think you see there's a bit of an edginess tomorrow, but trust me, we've been into the lads. We've shown them all they're great. There's no negativity from the Alec Vex game. That's gone. We can blame that on the pitch. We can use an excuse of a pitch for that one, and we're just going to be extremely positive. You've just got to tell them how great they are. Like I said, if they're listening to this, I've told them how much I absolutely love them. They're a credit. They are the best of the best, and I just so hope that tomorrow Boreham would get the absolute best of us, because if they get the absolute best of us, then it could be trouble for them tomorrow.
Yeah, no, I'm going a little bit off here, but I just want to touch back on what you said about sort of the fear of failure and sort of how the fans, especially for England, reacted at points. I think there is something in that when you look at players as not people and just somebody that's earning a lot of money and you don't get that connection with them, like you say, the FA sort of blocked that, whereas I've watched England women for a long time, I've watched the WSL Women's Championship for a long time, and you sort of did get to know the players then. So when you're watching them on the pitch, you sort of know them, and if they make a mistake, then they make a mistake, it happens. But like you say, people are so far back from that sometimes that they don't realise, and I think we get that, we don't get that with Chesterfield, because it's on that level that, you know, the fans know that the players are people and that they're doing their best, and, you know, I just feel like there's more of a community feel.
Like I said, when I first came up here for that Bradford game, it shocked me, the fan base, how everyone's together. It is a proper family club. Everyone I know everybody's name, staff-wise. Mm-hmm. It's just one big family. And I think that's reflected with the team you're seeing out on the pitch. It's just not just the team or us coaching staff. It's the chef. It's the ladies who work in the office. It's everyone. And like I said, one of the things that I couldn't believe is that we're a National League club, but we have got staff and players that are a lot better for the level, and it's showing. And that bodes well for next season. Look, we've got a long way to go. Like I said, we might have to tinker with things. We've already had meetings at different stages of the season, looking at recruitment, how we can build the squad. So now that Ash and Phil have taken over, I trust them 100%. They have done wonders for this club. They're wonderful human beings, and yeah, I'm not just me. I'm telling everyone listening, the future is very bright for this football club.
Well, we can't ignore your England career, 33 caps under Keegan, Ericsson and McLaren. Which of those managers made you feel most wanted, or you feel sort of made you feel more comfortable within the England squad?
All of them, to be honest. Like I said, with Kevin Keegan, when you turned up for a squad, you thought you definitely had a chance to play him. But with McLaren and Sven, and that's not a knock on him, there was a pecking order. And like you said, when you're listening to the players that I'm listening, you could say, rightly so, there was a pecking order. Sven gets a lot of stick, and when you talk about fine margins, like we're talking about maybe a goalkeeper mistake at Wembley cost us from going into League 2 last season. So if you look at the Euro 96 team, they are classed as heroes with the Terry Venables, and they lost unluckily to... Germany.
Yeah. Obviously, I was on the banks of the Baltic Sea that night. We were trying to find a signal to watch the match, and we only got it just towards the end of extra time. Cut in.
So if you look at that team, they drew to Switzerland in the first game. Mm-hmm. They struggled against Scotland in the next game. Struggled until Gazza comes out some magic, and Seaman saves a penalty. We played really well against Holland. That was the best we played, probably the best game in the tournament. Then we played Spain. We weren't very good. They had a goal that in today's game with the VAR would have been allowed, and we could have gone out. We beat them on penalties, and then obviously we know what happened to Germany. So we lost to Brazil in 2002, and we were classed as failures because we lost in the quarterfinals when Ronaldinho scored the free goal. But if you look at their team, their front three was Ronaldinho on one wing, Rivaldo on the other wing, and Ronaldo through the middle. That's like six Ballon d'Or. That's like six Ballon d'Ors between them.
Yeah.
And then they had the two best fullbacks ever in world football in Roberto Carlos and Cafu. They had Gilberto and Astor, they had Lucio at the back. And I'm thinking, yeah, we are the golden generation, but that's a super golden generation. We're classed as failures. And then in the 2004, what I went to, we lost to Portugal on penalties. And then in 2006, we lost the penalties. So when Sven gets labelled with his brush that he failed because of the golden generation, we got knocked out on penalties twice, which everyone says is a lottery. So I thought he got a lot of stick, and obviously he's going through his health issues at the moment, and yeah. I wish him all the best.
Well, in those two tournaments you mentioned, 2002, 2004, you went into 2002 injured, didn't get a lot of minutes in 2004, but how was it being a member of a squad, because you're there for weeks on end, there's a lot of boredom and everything along those lines. How difficult, if that's the right word, is it to go through a tournament like that, or is it easy?
So there's a big, I class it as a myth, because they say when you went up to England squads and you had the Chelsea boys didn't really want to connect with the Liverpool boys, and the Liverpool boys didn't want to kick with the Man United boys, and I could see some of that, but I was one of these players, a bit like Wazza. I could go with the golden oldies of Southgate and Martin Keown and have a good conversation. I could go and join them. I could flip through. So I never really see that kind of politics in football. And I really enjoyed the squads. I loved it. I thought we were united. And you talk about boredom. They make your hotel into like, that's like a pleasure bit. You're like, you've got every arcade, you've got every computer, you've got table tennis, you've got pool tables, you've got darts. It's just like, you can't get bored.
You
can't get bored. England go through, and obviously today, the way they're going and with the technology and now, you cannot get bored. We used to have like race nights and stuff like that where we'd have a pretend bookie and we were always amused. So,
but Michael Owen normally was.
Yes, of course. Yes, Michael. Bless you. So yeah, no, it was great team spirit. And like I said, we just, that 2002, if we'd have beat Brazil, we'd have won the World Cup, but we played a great Brazil team.
Anyway, you obviously were starting to suffer with injuries. At the point that you realised you were going to have to accept that your playing career had ended, how did that happen? I know you'd been struggling for quite a while at West Ham particularly, but there was a little bit after that QPR, Middlesbrough. Was it very, very difficult to accept, or was it because you could see it coming,
you'd worked
it through?
I was relieved. I'd relieved. Like I said, I was now coming to the stage in my life and career where all I felt was embarrassment. I felt like, because I was on good, really good money at West Ham, and like, I don't think I played three games on the trot, and people talk about we don't care because we get money. I felt embarrassed to be taking my wage. I think I talk in my book when I finished my career at Middlesbrough, the manager Tony Mowbray at the time didn't realise if I played one more game, because of my injuries, if I played like half the games in a month, I'd get my full wages, and if I didn't, then I'd be like on really low wages. And he was going to play me in the game, which would have meant I'd have played half the games in a month, and we couldn't make the playoffs, and it was just a dead rubber game. And like I said, because I felt embarrassed, I said to Tony, you do know if you play me, you're going to cost the club fib of it. Why don't you not play me and seed your training pitches and invest in your pay? And he couldn't believe it. But that was just me. Like, I was fed up of taking without giving anything. So when I called it a day, I was quite relieved, and I knew I made the right decision, because I remember my mum speaking to me about 4 months later, and she said, I finally got my son back. She could see how much the last 4 years of my career just really, really weighed me down, and it was a relief, and I never regret it, even today. Like, people say, do you miss that you don't play football? And no, because the last 4 years of my life, my career was just terrible. Hated it.
Yeah, just got a bit of Armando Dobber action. That's what we need.
Yeah, exactly.
So, after football, bit of reality TV. How was I'm a Celeb? I bet that was quite tough.
Yeah, so they'd requested me for a while. And because I wanted to be a coach, I thought if I went into reality TV, it would be like, you wouldn't be taken serious as being a coach. But because my children now, obviously my oldest boy, Kai, and my daughter, Lexi, they got to see me play because they were at that age. But my youngest in Caden and Cody, they had never really, all they'd seen me is suffer misery. And it was a family show we always used to love, and the Bush Tucker trials, and you kind of game plan, and I could do that easier than that. And like I said, they'd been asking me, and then they said, look, will you come and meet the producers? So I went down to meet the producers, and I knew straight away they were going to pick me. So I'm talking about their casting hundreds and hundreds of people, but I just knew from the producers and what I was saying to them. Obviously, everyone loves the Lee Bowyer fight story, and I thought they think that's good TV and stuff like that. And yeah, that. But it's really quick, so you don't hear nothing. And then obviously the show, you go into the show in November, mid-November, and it was like November the 1st, and I was on a family holiday, and I get the call, and they were like, they want you on it. You have to make a decision in like a couple of days. I was like, what? So like, I was speaking to my wife, and she said, listen, I know you want to be a coach, but this is fantastic for the kids. And I went and done it, and they loved it. I thought it was quite boring, to be honest, because you obviously see all the good stuff. So when you get to do trials and you get to do stuff like that, is one of the most amazing things ever. But if you don't get picked to do trials and that, I just slept all day. I was just bored out of my head. But the kids loved it. It was a wonderful experience, and I gave them some joy. So I really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine as someone who's been active their whole life to just sit there and wait all day, not know
and
what
like,
time it is.
And you're in there with reality TV stars, and they love the limelight. I'm not knocking them. They know how to get the limelight, and I'm just like, I shouldn't really be in these conversations. I have got nothing to offer at all. So, yeah, it is what it is. But I did really well. I was hoping was like, don't be the first voted out. Because at that time, I thought that because I was classed as a soccer brat and a soccer bad boy, I thought like the country kind of like disliked me. And I got to the penultimate day. So I came fourth. So I didn't quite make the final day, but I did the cyclone. And I was like, so every time there was an eviction, I was staying on. I was like, bloody hell. And then like all the messages were like, you come across really well. You ain't this and that. And I was like, yeah, it's actually, if you speak to me and find out about me, you might actually see there is someone rather than a bad boy.
Yeah, that can be the thing with reality TV sometimes, that people actually find out what you
yeah, of course,
really
yeah.
like.
Yeah, 100%.
And apart from a punctured lung and some cracked ribs, what was the toughest thing about
So, obviously, Phil probably knows, or he does know in my book, when I talk about the sexual abuse I suffered as a kid, I'd gone to see a lot of people. I kept it a secret for years, and then I opened up and got help, and they really helped me see the way. But when I went onto that show, all people think with the Ant Middleton and the Foxes of the world, the SAS people, is that they just swear at you, they shout at you. But they could sense a lot of things with my, where I couldn't get eye contact with people because of what happened when I was younger and stuff like that, and how I always kind of like talked down on myself. And they were unbelievable for me. Honestly, stuff they did with me, what wasn't aired on the show, they gave me more help and made me feel more positive about myself, even though they're calling me every name under the sun. It's honestly, they are incredible what they do. And I still keep in touch with Ant. And like I said, he's the way I am in life today. He's a big part of that. And I'm so thankful I did that show. It was the toughest show I've ever done. They are like supermen. And like, I thought I was fit, and I was like, these lot are on a different level.
Well, hopefully it's not been too tough tonight. We're just going to end up really with some quick fire questions or names or anything. I'm just going to say a name or something, and just give us a quick fire answer. One word if you want, a whole load of words if you want. But the first is a question. Did you know that you're one of only three players to play the last game at Old Wembley and the first game at New Wembley?
I did know that. I don't know who the other two
are. Oh, so that was the next bit, the other two.
So I'll try and guess the other two. I will go for, well, David Beckham played against Germany and he played against Brazil. So David Beckham.
Correct.
And Gary Neville started, but did he start? No, Michael Richards might have played.
If you went to the bookies, you get good odds.
John Terry didn't play. Rio didn't play.
Come on, that's a clue. Right.
There'd be Owen you lose.
Michael Owen. Michael Owen. So Beckham, Owen, Dyer.
Yeah.
It's a 7-year gap, so it just shows the longevity of the career as well.
Exactly,
doesn't it?
Yeah,
really, really. Right, so we're on the one worders now. Oh, well, come on.
Craig Bellamy.
Best friend in football.
Tony Adams.
Best captain ever.
Jerry Barton.
Misunderstood.
Lee Bowyer.
Not a hard puncher.
Chris Eubank.
Father figure.
Oh, right, yeah. Because you like boxing, don't you? Yeah, you do enjoy your boxing, yeah. Alan Shearer?
Legend.
I was writing your book.
I just spoke. I got someone to write it. It was therapeutic, to be honest. Really therapeutic.
Gareth Southgate.
Nicest man ever.
Will Grigg.
Goals.
Gary Roberts.
Getting better. Get nearly as good as me as a coach.
How would you describe your mum and how important she's been?
My hero. Superhero. Yeah, she's my world.
You can change your answer if you want, because the next one and the last one is Holly.
Oh,
sorry.
Superhero too.
Well, Kieran, it's been a real pleasure having you. Really grateful that you'd come and give an hour of your time. It's been a fantastic. Hopefully, everybody's enjoyed it. We'll be repeating at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning ahead of the Boreham Wood game, and I think there will be a video of it coming out and a podcast coming out of it as well. So if you've not had a chance to listen to it all, there will be a second chance. So thanks again, Kieran. Don't forget to listen to View from the Cop with John Chubb from 10 o'clock tomorrow, and of course the 1866 live from 2 o'clock. 3 o'clock kickoff for Boreham Wood. Chesterfield will, won't they? They will win the championship on Saturday at 3. Kieran, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Ellie, as well. So, well, let's hope tomorrow is a big, big day for Chesterfield and the EFL is back on the radar. Thank you very much for listening.